Hi. Welcome to the second talk in room one here. The presentation is Sandor Gaken from the University in Stuttgart. The topic is the trust situation, why data protection does not protect much anymore. The idea is that the laws or the idea of data protection is completely incapable of actually protecting the self-awareness, the concept of from the psychological view of data protection. So, hats off for him. Give him an applause. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Indeed, I want to put a little criticism on data protection because I think it's a bit of an ineffective tool when it comes to what is actually there to protect, or what I believe it should protect primarily. So what is that? What should it protect primarily? I believe it's informational self-determination. That I need to elaborate a little on that because it's a very German concept. I'm not sure how the English-speaking countries handle that. We had the decision in the so-called Volkszählungsurteil, where the constitutional judges said that there was a big census thing going on in Germany, and there was a lot of opposition to that, so it finally came up to the Constitutional Court, and then the Constitutional Court actually made a very wise, very smart decision. They said, well, we cannot do this census because if the state authorities or some other authorities know something about you and you don't know what that is, then you might adjust your behavior just to be on the safe side or to prevent some sort of consequences which you might fear. You know, that's the basic idea of informational self-determination. You should have sufficient knowledge about who knows what about you, because if you don't, then you might adjust your behavior. And if you adjust your behavior preemptively to prevent some sort of probable consequences or whatever, then you're manipulating yourself. And the authorities who surveil you are producing that kind of manipulation. So you're manipulating yourself in a specific way, in a way the authorities want you to manipulate. And that, of course, is something which we cannot stand in a democracy, because a democracy consists of free people, and free people are certainly not people who manipulate themselves in the first place. So informational self-determination is a very important thing for democracy, and that's why it was a constitutional thing, a constitutional court ruling on that point. And as I already said, it's very fundamental for freedom, you know, and you can easily think of some institutions where we have freedom, the term freedom institutionalized. We speak about the free press, free voting, free opinion, and of course all these things cannot really count if you're in a system where you're already manipulating yourself because you're afraid of the state knowing something about you and where you have to fear repercussions. Take Russia, for instance, where people are standing in the election chambers and watching the people electing and making where they make their cross, you know. Of course, when you're surveilled like that and when you know that the state wants a certain thing from you, and if you don't make that cross there, then you're going to have to answer a question and fear repercussion, then the mere fact of somebody standing in the corner, of somebody surveilling you, robs you of your freedom, deprives you of your freedom, you know. And the same is with a free press. When you have a free when you have a press where somebody's sitting there from the state watching what you're doing, and if you're probably doing some writing something they don't like, you're gonna have to answer some questions afterwards, then you're not free either, you know. So all these terms, free press, free vote, free opinion, couple of freedoms we have actually become mere maculature and mere well, in Germany we say paper tigers, when you as soon as you deprive the people working in there of their informational self-determination. So informational self-determination really is a very fundamental thing for many notions we have of freedom, and many notions which are very important for our societal and wider conception of freedom, right? I mean, this is really like, it's not like the way American presidents talk about freedom, you know, freedom here, freedom there, freedom this, freedom that. But this is really the material basis of freedom, yeah? You feel free. You have to feel free, to be able to feel free, to behave free, to do things in a free way, you have to have your informational self-determination. So, we can see that it's a very important thing. Now the question, how is it enforced? Of course we know that authorities, state authorities, economy as well, I think economy is also a big evil to to be considered here. They have a lot of interest in surveillance. They have a lot of interest in our data and information, in watching us, so they could be manipulating us, you know. There's a couple of examples. I will give some later on. But so the question is, how can I afford that? How can I enforce informational self-determination when there are so many very powerful agents actually interested in my data? And there are two concepts. The first concept has been avoidance of surveillance, avoidance of data, right? We just say that was the very decision they made in the census and back in 1983. They said, well, we're not going to have the census, and then if no data are produced anyway, if nobody knows anything about you, then you know for certain that nobody does, and then you can be freely, decide freely, and you don't have to fear any repercussions or anything. That's sort of the traditional thing. But as you all know from recent years, that's not an option anymore, right? Surveillance is everywhere, really everywhere. There's a lot of agents coming up. We've long lost oversight, who's doing what, who's interested in what, which technologies are at play and stuff like that. So there's a really strong rise of large-scale, highly efficient surveillance. And the particular thing about that new kind of surveillance we're facing is, of course, in connection with this new paradigm of crime fighting, which is worldwide being followed by the police. I've already mentioned that earlier. The police has changed its method of crime fighting, largely not due to 9/11. It was after 9/11, of course, but more due to the technical capacities they have now. They don't want to investigate crimes after they happen anymore, like they did in Tatort, right? I mean, the traditional Tatort commissar, then somebody murders some guy, and then he goes there and investigates all the stuff and looks what happened and stuff. And that's no more the idea they're following. Actually, the Bundeskriminalamt in Germany has already devoted large parts of its power, manpower, to this other method of crime fighting, namely preventing crimes before they happen. Yeah, which is really sort of a strange idea. It's like Minority Report or something, you know. And you ask yourselves immediately, how can they do that? How can they prevent crimes before they happen? How can they make that an official paradigm, investing a lot of money, building a lot of organizational structures in which, in fact, the majority of the German police commissars at the Bundeskriminalamt are already working in? And the answer is, of course, well, surveillance, right? You have to identify groups of people which are suspicious or which could commit crimes. And that's a thing of large-scale identificatory surveillance, which really scans everyone and then makes profiles, generates profiles, and identifies certain types of people to be potential suspects or suspicious. And then you have to watch them, observe them continuously, and see if they behave suspicious, more suspicious than you already think they are, in order to sort them out before they do something bad. So that's what we're facing right now, and any idea of avoidance of surveillance seems gone, really. So that's something which we only meet in some partial concepts which are slowly developed now, like privacy-enhancing technologies, where we say we have to embed some privacy-enhancing stuff into the technology and so on to avoid certain data. But generally, the concept of avoidance of surveillance is really gone. So how do we enforce informational self-determination? What's the new idea? Because we haven't given up on that, of course, not officially. So the new idea, which has followed for a while now, which we all know, is data protection, right? We came up with this idea of data protection, Datenschutz, also a very German thing in the beginnings, at least. And what data protection does is to regulate the evaluation and use of data which are generated within surveillance, and to that by laws and regulations, organizational structures and stuff. And that, again, is a very complex thing to do. I mean, meanwhile, data protection has grown into a very complex canon of laws, of organizations, a lot of intertwinglings there with the industry, and a lot of different positions you can assume there. So really, it's been growing a big thing. There are many exceptions, of course. That's something we are witnessing as well. As soon as some certain particular surveillance measures come out of the press, like 2 or 3 years after it has been publicly debated, then the police slowly starts to, and the industry, they slowly start to get exceptions, and so they're always nagging on these things and making them vanish, sort of. But in general, that's the idea of how we can manage informational self-determination, right, by data protection, because we can't avoid it anymore, so we have to protect the way in which data are evaluated and used. Now the question is how precisely does data protection want to produce informational self-determination? And then the idea, of course, is, well, data protection aims to provide the public with sufficient knowledge about which data are known where. Like the idea is in principle, if you want to be informationally self-determined, you can call those guys from data protection and you can ask them, well, who knows what about me? And then you know that, you have the sufficient knowledge to decide, and then you can make informationally self-determined decisions again, be informed. But the question now is whether data protection really does that. And that's the question which I want to pose here for my talk. And my hypothesis here is no, it's unable to do that, and it's even unable to do that in principle. That's what I'm going to argue for now. And a few questions is, I mean, I'm going to give you the bottom line of what I'm aiming at before, so you have sort of an idea what I'm going at. I think that really to be informationally self-determined or to have sufficient knowledge to decide freely and to decide informed, you would have to have a lot of stuff actually about data protection, about surveillance, and that's just utterly impossible. So data protection really lives on sort of some very hypothetical idea of how we could have sufficient knowledge about these situations. That's something I'm going to try to elaborate. So like the knowledge of real people is not working like that, the way data protection thinks it is. So, and to come to this notion, I just want to follow a few questions. Like the first is, what is sufficient knowledge to decide freely and self-determine? And how does decision-making actually work psychologically? You know, what are the processes really which we have to look at when we want to reassure people some sort of ability to decide freely and to decide based on knowledge? And then, of course, when we get that knowledge and that little insight, we can ask ourselves, does data protection actually provide sufficient knowledge in that particular sense? Okay, now it's going to be a bit theoretical. I'm a scientist, so sorry, I have to go to theory first. And the theory I'm going to use now is decision theory. We're going to look first at some categorization from decision theory, because basically there are two kinds of knowledge-based decisions. The first one is the good kind. That's deciding with certainty, right? And that was something we had in the avoidance situation. I was knowing for certain that the state didn't have any information about me, so everything was definite, everything was known, and all the consequences could be foreseen much more clearly. The situation was not very complex, so I could decide with certainty in any sort of situation where surveillance might have been an issue, right? But that's not the case anymore. So now we have, oh, that's bad. Now we have the bad kind of decision which we're facing. Of course, the majority of the decisions we're facing are always like that. We have to decide with uncertainty, right? Not everything is definite, not everything is known. The consequences cannot be entirely foreseen. And the situation is somewhat complex, so I'm not really able to cognitively think of all the factors and involve everything that would have to be involved to make a really deeply informed decision. Decision theory then varies some degrees and produces further types, decision under risk, indefinite decision, and so on. That's not so important. But important is that this is a very important kind of decision, because usually the decisions we make are always under some kind of uncertainty. We never know fully all the consequences, fully all the things we have to know to judge in a certain situation. So that's the type, of course, I want to be looking at a bit more closely, because that's the type which we'll be facing in our situation with data protection as well. So how do we calculate our odds for uncertain decision, right? We have to calculate something, look at what's the outcome of that option, what's the outcome of the other option, and then see and make a trade or find some way to decide that. And what does decision theory say how that works? Well, back in the old days, which is really like the 1920s, 1930s, they said, well, that's a rational thing, of course, right? And we all know what that means. We had all these theories coming up back then, rational choice theory, game theory, these Maximian models and all that kind of stuff, which says how you should ideally and rationally make your decisions, and said like, okay, you have these and these options, then you apply certain rules to that, and then you calculate everything, and then in the end you know what is the best decision, you know. But and actually back in the old days, they were really of the opinion that we would actually always be making decisions like that, you know, that was like the hidden mechanism with which we do all the decisions in our everyday lives. But of course, with just a little second of insight, you can see that is not the case, right? When I have a decision to make, I do not just go down to the table and start calculating all my odds and probabilities, you know? I just do it more out of the stomach. So criticism started in the 50s in this, onto this very rational model. And a couple of scientists came up who said that actually humans in complex situations are neither willing nor able to calculate all the time, right? You don't go down to the table, calculate all your odds in front of every decision. So what they rather do is they use some sort of shortcut strategies to decide. They don't do this full-fledged rational game theory stuff. They use other strategies, you know? They don't have time and they have to find some quick way, so okay. And how does this go? That's a process they call heuristic decision-making. Tversky and Kahneman were two scientists, I think economists, and they were very famous for finding out how actual decisions are being made. The landmark paper is 1975, and they got the Nobel Prize for that in 2005. And they said, well, in actual decisions, we're working kind of heuristic, right? Heuristic is some reduced framework where you highlight some perspectives and leave some other perspectives out of sight to get a clearer picture of what you want to do in a certain aspect. And we're actually not working with this full kind of rationality. We're working with a reduced rationality, right? We judge situations coarsely. We use our everyday knowledge. We don't check every fact, right? We don't look into science every time we have to make a decision on what to buy or what to eat, right? Because in a rational world, that would be what you would have to do, you know? And then the depth of your investigation actually depends on how relevant it is for you. But usually, you don't bother for the most complete and correct information possible, right? I mean, everyday people, they just decide, well, they have heard this and they've heard that, and so, well, okay, I'm going to do this, you know. It's not so terribly important. I'm not going to check everything, so it's not a court case here. I've just decided like that. And in most cases, of course, you're not even capable of doing that. I mean, most people are no scientists, and they're not even very, very smart at gathering information. They don't have routines or methods to gather information, to analyze information. So they sort of have to rely on hearsay knowledge, right? On what people say and what they've heard and so on and so forth. And that's how they actually make their decisions, you know? They rely on a few facts of hearsay knowledge. Exception, of course, the hackers. The hackers are always very informed about everything. And what's even worse about that, we're not only having this reduced rationality that we're only deciding upon a reduced number of hearsay facts, we're also psychologically biased. That's the other thing they found out, Tversky and Kahneman in 1975, by looking at a lot of decisions and how people are making decisions. And the big bias number one is that you love your own values, you know, and your values are always getting into your decisions, right? But no, that's something the rational decision theory has never thought of. You know, rational decision theory said, we're doing this unemotionally, right? We're calculating all the odds, and game theory says this and that, and whatever the outcome is, that's what we're going to do. But of course, that's not the case, you know? You favor certain facts. You tend to memorize things in support of your own values much more than things which are not in support of your values. I mean, that could also be negative facts. If you remember all the things Schäuble said or did because you're opposed to what he does, then that, of course, is something you take to support your values, you know? So whatever you have as a hearsay knowledge already is biased from the beginning. What the basic set you have as a knowledge is already biased by the values you have. So there goes a tiny bit of that rationality idea. Then what you choose as relevant facts from what you hear depends a lot as well on what you want to be relevant facts, right? If you have a preset opinion, what you want to know, what you want to don't, what you don't want to know, then that's how you sort your facts with which you hear in a certain decision situation. When somebody tells you, this and this and this, and consider this and this and that, then you just say, okay, well, I don't like this, I don't like this, but that I like, that I consider, and so that's how you sort what's relevant. And another thing that's also always very relevant is that the public opinion of your own cultural or subcultural group is very influential, right? Whatever the people say around you and how you, especially in particular the people who constitute your own societal values, or represent those, that's the people which you're following in your decision making or in your knowledge, in your values, because you don't want to stand outside. So your knowledge is already deeply biased by values. And then bias number two is that they're given this already very tendentious situation and almost irrational, or at least much less rational situation than anyone would have ever thought, there are some further characteristic effects which have been found in psychology, the decision of psychologies, the psychology of decisions. The one is the anchor effect. I just mentioned three here. There are a bit more, but these three are the most relevant. The anchor effect, for instance, is very known to you. Everybody will know this thing. Very colorful and very recent facts are more present than other, right? What happened in the news yesterday and the thing that was printed in the big red letters, that is something which appears much more factual than anything you have heard last year in the FAZ with just a small kind of text thing. Then familiarity effect. Frequently heard facts appear to be more true and more frequent than others. That's a big problem, I believe, to our democracy in general, because the media, of course, they love the dramatic stories, and they love like stories about child pornography, or they love stories about terrorists bombing stuff. So whenever something like that happens, they actually run it over and over and over again, you know, over weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And the best example is like private TV. When they get good footage from some amateur filmer of some strange thing happened, they show that like five times in a row in one news flash. You know, it's really crazy. But because it's good material, it's dramatic, so it has to be repeated. People like that, people read that. So they're repeating it over and over. And you get the impression psychologically, without, of course, noticing rationally, that this is happening all the time, you know? And that's a particular fact which is known with this child molester problematic. If you ask people how many children are actually murdered by perverts every year, they say something about, well, it must be 100 or something. But actually, it's about 4 or 5, right, in the whole of Germany for 1 year. And that's exactly precisely this shift we have in our perception, because that's the way we gather facts. And another effect is, I don't know if I translated that correctly, it's Repräsentativitäts effect in Germany, representativeness effect. People are judged by the stereotype they're taken to represent, right? When you get news or when you get knowledge, gather knowledge, and there are certain people involved like who are in a certain stereotype, like lawyers, or politicians, or whatever, or politicians of a certain party, then you already judge them by the stereotype you have of this particular people, right? You don't look into the particular profiles of these people, or you don't look very precisely at what they say, what they do, what their opinions are, because you think you already know them, but just by the stereotype they represent, right? So that's something that goes into there as well. Uncertain decision-making, right? That's not a very rational thing. It's based on a reduced number of facts, mostly from your own hearsay knowledge. It's largely unchecked. It's favorably by use of facts which are in support of your opinion in the first place, which are very colorful, very recent, or simply heard a lot. And people appearing in your decisions generally appear as preset stereotypes. So that's really, I think, that's a very different picture from what we usually have from decision-making when we think, oh, we're so smart, we're so rational, we're calculating the odds, and anyway, we're finding the best decision, you know. No, that's not the case, you know. We're very biased, we're very psychologically determined in what we decide, and very irrational in a way. So, that was a bit of an excursion to decision theory. Now let's get back to surveillance. So I already said deciding and surveillance, how does that situation look? And I always said, back in the old days of avoidance, we could decide with certainty. When we are in a situation where surveillance is relevant for us, that's always like the action we have to consider here. When surveillance is relevant for us, how do we decide? And back in the old days, that was a decision with certainty, because I knew for sure that there was no surveillance, nobody had data, and I could decide with certainty. But today, there's a decision with deep uncertainty, actually. and especially now, these very days, there are decisions which are really difficult to make. Because there's a huge number of facts to consider, really, if you want to go into it and make an informed decision. I guess we here are experts, but I guess no one of you will be able to make a 100% informed decision about any surveillance-related situation, right? Because there are much too many facts to consider. You know, there are a lot of technological options, many of which are hidden, are secret, so even hard to know in general. Then there are many potential surveillers with too many interests. You can't really look into them, what they're really after. You don't know how many agents are after you, how many commercial agents are surveilling your electronic behavior, what the state does with the information. Those are all things which you really don't have a full-fledged picture of, right? Because it's very difficult. It's a very complex situation. So everything is too complex to understand in principle. Even for us as experts, I can't speak for myself. I couldn't claim I have an oversight over everything happening with my data when I make a phone call or when I'm on the internet. And if that holds for me already, then the situation must be much worse for any lay people, you know, for any technical lay people or anybody who's not an expert. You know, they really can't decide anything with the slightest bit of certainty. So what does that mean when we go back to this decision theory thing, if we can't decide with certainty, but rather with a lot of uncertainty in surveillance-like situations? Well, public hearsay knowledge about surveillance will be very influential because I don't know all the real facts. I will remember all the facts that my friends have told me and the press has told me and all those, and that will be like the very basis upon which I decide. That will largely consist of what has been prominently in the press, of course, because what has been very colorful, what has been very loud, what has been repeated a lot. Then the general public opinion about surveillance will bias that knowledge even further, of course, also depending on the subculture I live in. And the public stereotypes of the involved agencies will be very relevant for the opinion and for the makeup of the whole knowledge. And what are those stereotypes? You know, that's lawyers, politicians, and all the big companies. So, well, so we can easily see that given this situation, some people will certainly not be informationally self-determined, and they will not be able to be informationally self-determined because they will not be able to have a sufficient factual or good knowledge preventing them from being suspicious about surveillance and preventing them from manipulating themselves in front of surveillance. People who possess a rather bad and skeptic hearsay knowledge about surveillance, which I believe is already a lot of people, people who have a bad or skeptic attitude towards it, which is you in particular, people who hear rather bad than good news about surveillance, and people who don't like the involved stereotypes, like the state, the big bosses, politicians, the police. The police still has good credibility in Germany, we have to acknowledge that, but generally it always depends on the situation you're in and the agencies which you're trying to recognize or which you think you see behind that. So when you're in a situation like this, then you will not be very informationally self-determined because you will think that you will be manipulated in your knowledge, you will be manipulated in your decisions. And now we can ask ourselves, well, what about data protection? Now we have sort of set out the problem. These people will not have a very factual knowledge or anything. And does data protection help us now? Does data protection provide us an anchor here, help us to get some certainty and rational basis for decision, to regain that? Does it do that? And I would say no, certainly does not. You know, data protection is a complicated and huge judicial apparatus itself, and it adds to complexity and uncertainty. You know, if I if I'm uncertain or suspicious about what's happening with my stuff and I want to look at data protection, and I mean, have you looked up the web pages of those guys? They have like huge pamphlets and laws and complicated stuff, really awful to read, boring. So it's not helping, really. It's not really giving you a rational basis or something you can rely on in your decision. And even the public facts they produce, the data protectors produce, are useless because they're still too much to read and it's hard to find them even. You know, they're not so very much in the press as well. And also data protection is much less a matter of public opinion. You know, it's the public doesn't have good knowledge about data protection, what that actually is or what it does. You know, so the public knowledge which you have to rely on in your decision about data protection is much worse than the public knowledge about surveillance. I've just been holding a talk in Kiel with the Datenschutzzentrum there, and then one guy told me that he was on a tour in a museum, and he was asked what his job was, and he said, "Well, I'm into data protection." And the tour guide said, "Oh, that still exists. You know, that's really the opinion they have. They don't know if that really exists or what it is or what it could be. So, it's not there." And of course, when you say that, well, whatever is much in the media or much in the news plays a more important role in your decision making, then we can ask ourselves, well, what's more in the media? Breaches of privacy and dramatic cases about surveillance, or success stories of protected data? You know, I haven't heard one success story of protected data or stuff like that, like which really in detail. You hear much more about what the guys are doing, what the bad stuff happening, and so that's bias of the public opinion already. And the stereotypes involved in data protection are not exactly trustworthy either. I mentioned that before. Many people have a suspicious attitude towards the state, towards the industry, towards the boss, and whoever wants your information, especially in Germany. So I think that the data protectors, or the people who invented data protection in order to help us in our informational, to maintain our informational self-determination, made a couple of mistakes. You know, they had this sort of this esoteric perception of themselves. Well, if I can know this and be informationally self-determined, anyone can. You know, that's a conclusion we find in many, many areas of society, which is always wrong. You know, because you have your own set of knowledge and values, and that doesn't mean that anyone else can do that as well. And of course, it's natural for them. These guys doing data protection, there's politicians, lawyers, and scientists, right? These three groups. And it's natural for them to overestimate rationality, because those are groups which rely on rationality a lot. You know, they are thinking rationality. They have to be rational in what they do, argue rational. So they think, well, rationality must really be the thing by which people live. You know, decision making must be rational and informed the way I know it. So I can assume that the public generally does this the way I do it. And of course, as well, they have a different perception of the involved stereotypes. You know, state authorities and lawyers, that's what they are, that's what their friends are, so they don't bother about that too much as well. But there are mistakes, because that's not a situation which holds for much of the society. And actually, we can see some cases already where certain social groups have lost their informational self-determination and where you can't bring it back. And those groups, and here I relate to the motto of the Congress, those groups are precisely those groups who think that they have something to hide, right? They don't really have to have something to hide, but as soon as they think they have something to hide, then they've lost their informational self-determination. They will start to manipulate themselves. And we can see some very alarming cases already. For instance, as I've been told from some politicians lately, they have witnessed that drug addicts and troubled families seek much less help lately. You know, we have all these offers for drug addicts or for troubled families to seek help, social help and stuff like that. And they're not going there anymore. And the people have been asking them, "Hey, why aren't you coming anymore? What's the matter?" And they say, "Well, I don't know what happens with my data. You know, you type all that in, and that's networked, and who knows who else knows that? And then maybe I don't get money, or maybe I come to jail or whatever. So I don't want to go there. I don't want to give you my data." And so they start to manipulate themselves already, right? They have lost their informational self-determination in fear of repercussions, what might happen with their data and surveillance. Another thing is press informants. That's something we have heard a lot too. You know, the press has been telling us we're losing our informants. Right? We're losing people who are telling us what's happening in the insides of politics and economy. Because those people fear that their anonymity cannot be guaranteed as well. You know, you see cases like the telecom scandal where then the big bosses, well, okay, there's data protection, but they do what they want anyway, you know, because they're big and powerful, and the worst thing that Peter Schaar can do is to say, well, don't do that again, you know. So, so of course, they fear, well, they will find out, you know. They can observe me, they do that, they fuck data protection, you know, they're doing that anyway, and I'm losing my job, and I'll never get a job again, so I keep quiet, you know. But we need those people, you know. We need those press informants. The whole idea of an independent press relies on press informants, on people who are brave enough to come up when some shady things are happening inside some organizations, you know. But that is something we have lost. We seem to have lost. And another point which we're losing is witnessed people in court cases, who are involved in court cases, like witnesses and accused. And they fear talking shop with their lawyers and telling them the truth, not because they distrust their lawyers, but they distrust the lawyers communicating with other lawyers, and they distrust the state probably surveilling the lawyers and stuff like that. We had cases like that happening. So they fear that, and they hold back the truth in front of their lawyers, and that's another thing which is very bad and happening as well. So what we see that the true in these cases in particular that the true basis of decision making is different. You know, we're not deciding rational upon our substantial and informed knowledge on data protection and surveillance when we come in such situations, or when people come in such situations. They decide upon the stuff they've heard. You know, the stuff they've heard in the news, the stuff their friends telling them. They keep exaggerating that because they have a certain opinion and so on. And that's what they rely on in their decision-making, you know? They have these faint ideas about what surveillance is, you know, it's omnipresent, unstoppable, networked, everything. And everyone powerful can, in principle, know a lot about me. That's something that really is diffused in the public mind already. And that's the basis upon which they decide. And, of course, that's not a basis anymore where you have your informational self-determination. There's something you have lost then. Yeah, you don't have any certainty by which you can decide. We can also see some foreseeable new problems coming up with the networking of databases and what has been called the eternal memory of databases and their public perception, right? Because then people start thinking about all this database stuff going on basically in the economy, but also from the state. And then some cases crop up in the press, you know, and then they see, these databases, then it's not such a good thing either. For instance, health databases are now being developed, and we know that there's some sort of function creep going on with databases, and, well, okay, they say it's all very confidential and only for medical personnel, and so, but what about in 10 years? I don't know, and so... If I have something bad now, do I really want to go to a doctor if I have to take the risk that somebody in 20 years will know that, which I probably don't want. You know? Another thing is school databases, which they're currently coming up with in Berlin here. If you're a kid you're a teenager, you're doing silly stuff, you know, and then you did something silly, and then you know of these databases. And you have to think, well, damn it, I did something wrong, I screwed up, oh man, and then I have this database and this thing will be following me for the rest of my life. Because in fact it will, you know, and we don't know what will happen with these databases and whether future employers can look into that, you know. So that also influences your informational self-determination, because you have this idea that something might happen with your data, and then you decide differently and you choose your path differently. So that's all a bit of a bad situation. We've really lost this sort of informational self-determination. And what can we do now? If we want to protect real people, not lawyer, super rational, super people, but real people who are irrational, who are too busy to gather all the facts, who are not scientifically minded, can we do anything to protect them, to provide them with something? And of course, there are a few options how we could shift the public knowledge or the public opinion more towards the direction of data protection, right? I mean, we would have to be a bit more dramatic and drastic in data protection to bring that to the public mind in a sufficient degree. We would have to dramatically increase penalties for data crimes, for instance, like nothing below 10 years of jail, which of course is entirely unthinkable. But that would have to be an option. We would have to have something like free and independent data protectors, you know, not lawyers and politicians, but people whom the average guy trusts. we would have to decomplexify and simplify surveillance again, so people could really go and look inside what's happening technologically. What are the technologies? What are the options at hand? What could happen to me, you know? That's not going to happen either. And we would have to decomplexify and simplify data protection a lot, you know? We would have to really bring out very clear-cut stuff which says, okay, this is what data protection can do for you and all that, you know, enlighten the public about that in very understandable terms. And of course, we would have to get good press and visibility for data protection to get sort of a counterweight to all the bad press we have from surveillance. But that's not really a real thing which is going to happen. I mean, let's be honest, that's out of sight, any of those things I said. And still, if all those things would happen, there would still be skeptical people and people who think they might probably have something to hide. And those will never again be informationally self-determined, you know, in any sort of surveillance-related situation. So society-wide manipulation just by the mere existence of surveillance is actually a fact, right? That's something we have to consider right now, no matter whether we have something to hide or not. So my conclusion, personal conclusion, is if we want informational self-determination back again, and we have seen that this is an important thing to do, then we should not go into trade-offs. You know, we should not say, well, okay, it's too late now, we have to try to make our way and try to find some way to get along with this. I say no, we have to go back, we have to be much more radical, and we have to say we want back this policy of avoidance of surveillance, right? We don't want these technologies, we don't want preemptive crime fighting, we don't want all this surveillance stuff. Get out of our country, get out of our minds, and we have to abandon that again. And if we don't do that, the only thing we can do, and I think we should do that as well, if we say that we're not able to abandon surveillance again, to avoid surveillance, then the least thing we should do is that we should not uphold this vain illusion of informational self-determination anymore. So if we're not able to actually protect that, we should admit that we've lost it. We should at least be honest enough to go out to the public and tell them, well, informational self-determination was a nice idea back in the 80s, but it's no longer existing, and deal with it, right? That's it. Thank you. When I was asked if you have questions, to please take the mics for the recordings, right? So anybody questions? Comments?
Yeah. Nothing?
Yes?
Nothing.
Give him a mic. Okay.
I totally agree with your conclusion that we have to get back to avoidance of surveillance. But isn't that a problem? Because a lot of uninformed people for whom the situation is already complex think we need surveillance, because there are things that upsets them, like child pornography, etc. These things upsets them, and they think we need surveillance, and so they think we cannot get back to avoidance of surveillance. I think it's impossible either.
Mm. Yeah, that's a different strain of argument, of course, to argue against surveillance in this these security-related situations. I think that is something where we have to politicize the public more, where we have to inform them more, where we have to tell them that surveillance is not even that efficient, you know, and that in the basic cost-benefit ratio which we have to make as a society, we pay much more, you know, we pay much more for basic values, for basic general ideas of democracy, of freedom, of civil rights, than we earn in the end with these few child molesters and these few terrorists whom the police would have caught anyway. I mean, that's another point, because all these efficiency studies which we do on surveillance technologies show that in the end they're not very efficient, you know. They would have found those people anyway. So we have to, that's a thing we have to do on another level, of course. So cost benefits.
Hello. While I don't disagree with your basic premise here, you're saying a few things which make me very scared and put my hairs on end. And the most scary thing you say is We must put power, in this case in terms of data protection, not in the hands of lawyers or politicians, but people, ordinary people, can trust. Now that is the basis of a populist argument, and in my mind it disconnects people from having to choose between politicians, having to choose the lesser of evil sometimes, actually watching what's going on, and disconnecting from the process in the hopes of finding someone to pop up that says, I am not a politician. Well, the worst politicians in history have said, I'm not like all the other politicians. So that in itself is not a characteristic by which we can choose people to have any power over us. Mm. So I think that's something where you have to really think and sort of refine your story.
Okay.
That's not working. It's historically been shown not to work.
Okay. Well, I see your point, but I've tried to stress before that really something we need in this surveillance situation is something like the free and independent press in a technology way. You know, we need the free and independent technologists. You know, somebody who's not paid for by the state, somebody who's not paid for by the industry, but somebody who's doing this out of his own free will and probably in an institution. You know, not like the populist kind. But who can be trusted more as an independent source of knowledge and somebody who's really relying on an independent set of values as well. Now that was more the direction I wanted to point to, because actually I meet that problem a lot with people who are in public discussions. For instance, a lot of people say that, well, I don't trust these data protection guys, you know. That's lawyers. They're paid by the state, or the data protection guy in my company, you know, he works very close with the boss and he's paid by the boss. I don't trust him, you know. I don't like him, you know. And that's the thing I say. We need some sort of independent positions there. Do you agree with that, or? Yeah? Okay. Further questions?
You said before that we have to politicize the people because of forgetting them. Yeah, actually say that surveillance is not a good idea because of the efficiency. But the problem is that mainstream media actually influences the decisions of the people, what you said before in your presentation as well. But the mainstream media works with fear. And you actually have to change the mainstream media that the people do not have any more the fear, because they want surveillance because they think that they have less fear because of the surveillance.
Hmm. Okay, yeah. Well, I don't think we can change the media, although the pattern of media in which media work. I wish we could, because I see a lot of problems there in this media perception and everything. But I also think, or I've also made get the impression over the past years that the media are also working for us. You know, it's like when all these cases are in the media where data protection doesn't work, or when the telecom scandal, for instance, comes to the press, then in a way, this in terms of politicizing things, that usually helps us. You know, so we could, but I think we should try and contact the press a bit more, you know, could try and work together with them, find more scandals, give them more materials so we can get a counterweight to all this fear-making on terrorism with the fear-making of what happens when your data are lost. I think that's it's not a good way, but from an activist point of view, and that's the way I think we should handle that politically. Yeah?
Okay. Basically, adding on to that, I think one of the key problems is that once the sphere is created, again, like terrorism is a fear of life, what's losing access to personal data is not so not perceived as terrifying as dying in a terrorist incident. Therefore, I think what we need in order to fight against this fear of like terrorism or the other current threats we experience, we need to find alternative situations and find other ways to approach these problems, tell people, hey, this is not a way out. Giving up our privacy isn't a good solution. And I think I've heard the argument of in favor of CCTV surveillance. It's a good idea against rapes and lone parks at night and things like that. And if you tell people that this is actually not doing anything to prevent crimes, but instead the simple installation of light sources does much more to protect people at night. I think that's the kind of alternative solution we have to find, but yeah, anyways.
Yeah, no, I totally agree that that's certainly an important point where we need to work a lot harder. But that's also what I wanted to say in my opening speech, that we have a lot of arguments already. I mean, surveillance studies is a broad field which has developed a huge, vast amount of very good arguments against surveillance, which are independent of all these security issues in the first place, you know. And we would have to, the thing we have to do as activists is publicize these things and use them to politicize the people, you know, because there is another point about surveillance and there is another point about privacy which we can stress. We just have to do that more often, you know. So I think that would be something which we could use as a counterweight to all these security issues. And then another thing I've always been trying to argue is that stuff like freedom and privacy are security issues as well, you know, because they protect me from a centralized, overpowered state, you know, and that is something which has always cost a lot of lives, you know. That's probably not going to happen today, not next year, but probably in 20 years, you know. And then surveillance is a security issue in itself, so that's something you have to consider as well. I mean, also, as a society, that's something which many ethicists of technology say, we have to be able to take some risks. You know, as a democratic, free society, we have to be able to live with the risk of terrorists, and we can't just build an overarching and huge apparatus of security surveillance because that contradicts our ideas of freedom and democracy. And that's just. Any further questions?
Yes, one, and I think it fits, because where are these studies that you speak of that we have to publicize? And most important, how can I show someone that has a different opinion that informants in politics and economy really are getting fewer because they fear surveillance? So how can I show someone that these are facts, that we pay more than we gain through surveillance?
Okay. Well, look at surveillance studies. That's an interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary research field. They have produced a lot. You can also contact me, write me. I'll send you a list of readings and of arguments. You can also look up some former talks of me. I've been trying to mention a couple of these arguments already in earlier talks. And the situation with the informants to the press is something that's still pretty new. It's not really publicized on a broad scale. We heard that because we are contacted by the press and they're telling us they need something to protect their informants because they're losing their informants. Can we do something? Can we help them? But that's just been cropping up over the last year. So I think it still takes a while to get into the public mind or to get investigated scientifically or by the press. So I don't know how else to answer that. Yes.
Another point that I see is, at this moment, the freedom is still here, but nobody uses it because they fear too much the consequences. So I would say we should more remind the people to use the right for freedom to say, no, I don't want to give my data here.
Mm. Yeah, certainly, I totally agree. But that's something we haven't been doing much, and that's something where we have to look at our own responsibility. We don't just a thing we usually always did in the club was to inform the people, you know, continuously inform the people, give out press information and all that stuff. So, but one thing we never did or didn't do until very recently was to give them some sort of forum where they could just raise their voice, raise their hands, or show up. You know, we like organize demonstrations, organize, I don't know, workshops or some sort of discussions, public stuff like that. That's something we didn't do very much. We, of course, when you activate people by informing them all the time, you also have to give them some sort of forum to be active in. You know, that's something that certainly points to us that we have to do more into this direction.
Yeah, my question is kind of personal to you. What's the next step? We can argue with words and all the good and great arguments we had today, and people don't really know at all. And we can argue with actions. And I guess the whole leakage of data this year here in Germany and Britain raised people's attentions and did a great job. The telecom did a great job for us this year, kind of. And should we do more arguing in words or in action, like initiating the leakage of more data that it hurts even more?
Well, both, you know. I mean, we really have to work on a much broader scale than we did before. Of course, this data leakage is a good thing to show the people that the assurances which all these companies make that there is security with their data and that they can be safe about their data, that's just an illusion, you know. That's something we know as hackers, there is no security. Yeah, that's something we have to bring out to the public clear and loud to really make them know, well, okay, well, if there is no security, then anything I say, do, speak, or do electronically actually is a threat to me. And it can be known by anyone, and then maybe I know someone whom I don't want to know that. You know? So that's one thing we should certainly stress, and we should use these cases in the press to stress that particular point. But I think we also should pick up other lines of arguments and to use this general media attention we have now to bring other arguments into this discussion as well. As I mentioned some earlier, like the psychological set of mind you're going into, then there's their monoculture of values coming up. That would be too much to mention now, but we should do that as well.
Okay, I want to emphasize a little more on the data leakage problem. Early in your speech, you mentioned that Datenschutz has a history primarily in Germany, and then went on about data protection in terms of regulating who gets access to data that is present and who doesn't. And that is something I run into virtually every discussion about this topic I have had in the past. People usually understand the term Datenschutz in this way, that it means protecting data, but that's not what Datenschutz or data protection, it's not really a good translation of the term, what Datenschutz is all about. Datenschutz means protection of people from the abuse of their data, and regulating access to data that is stored from whoever won't just fit the bill, because as the scandals in the past year have shown, once data is gathered and stored somewhere, there will be abuse. It's just a matter of time. So we have to communicate to the people that it doesn't suffice to protect data that is stored somewhere and regulate who gets access to that data and who doesn't, but to make sure that the collection of data is avoided wherever possible.
I totally agree with you. You know, that's the point I've been trying to make, that we have to avoid that and return to this whole concept of avoidance of data. And another point I've been stressing as well is this regulation thing, you know, that precisely regulations are too soft, you know. They can change every other day, and they're actually changed by a lot of exceptions which are being brought in by the police and industry, and they're constantly changing the laws and everything. So regulations are crap, you know. The regulations are not any substantial basis to do anything. So we have to do it in a technological way, and we have to return to the basic concept of avoidance. So I totally agree with you. And I also agree with you on the point that data protection is a bad term, but that's the common English translation. But I also think that Datenschutz is a bad German term anyway, because it's such a bigger concept, and the term Datenschutz doesn't really grasp all the notions. So, okay. One more question? Any takers? John?
Well, it seems to me, if your conclusion is that data protection doesn't actually influence people to believe that their data is safe, and indeed their data isn't safe, then maybe we shouldn't be doing data protection. But instead, what I keep hearing is, oh, well, the cure for this problem is to do it even more. It's sort of like the drug war. If you can't eliminate drugs, make the penalties higher, even though it doesn't work. So it would seem to me the right thing to do would be eliminate the data protection laws and just inform people the sort of the Scott McNeely theory of privacy. You have no privacy. Get over it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point I've been trying to make as a last thing. You know, we should... we should abandon the whole idea of data protection, in fact, because I believe it's not effective, you know? It's not effective in a psychological sense to protect us from manipulating ourselves. It's not effective in any real sense because the regulations are changed all the time, and then the worst thing the data protectors can do is to sue some company, and then they have to pay like $5,000 out of their $10 million they earned last year. And you know, fuck that. Data protection doesn't serve anything, any of us, you know. It's just creates the illusion that something is there which helps us protect our privacy, which in fact doesn't. So it would be much more honest and much more straightforward to really abandon the whole thing of data protection and return to this idea avoidance of surveillance and alarm people about that they're losing their informational self-determination and their privacy no matter what. So I totally agree with you. Okay, then, thank you for your attention, and I hope you had a good time.